Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check us out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Also, you can email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I also want to let you know if you miss a show or you come in the middle, all the shows are archived. Check them out on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. And I just want to thank you guys for all your support and sharing. I'm happy that you guys are getting the giveaways. It is not a scam. I know there's a lot of stuff on the internet saying, you know, hey, you won a prize. If you see it from me, most likely it's for real. I always ask people to post when they get them so that people know that, you know, okay, she really did send it. They can't post the e-gift cards that I send, but books that I send or other items, I do try to get people to post because I do want you to know that is legitimate. And I get signed books, and those are really precious. So I think that's really special for people to see that you got it. Well, this morning, as you know, a historian of historians, really, I was just telling him his book has so many anecdotes. I mean, we would need like two or three shows to talk about everything in his book. But this is not his first book. But the book we're going to be talking about today is called The Boss of the Grit, The Life of James H. Williams and the Red Caps of Grand Central Terminal. Yes, the Red Caps. I'm sure you guys see the Red Caps now. When you go to 30th Street, if you're in Philadelphia, you might get them to carry your luggage. If you're in D.C. or New York, you know. But did you know the history of the Red Caps? This man delved deep into the history and to one of the leaders of the Red Caps. Good morning, Eric K. Washington.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for writing this book. Like I said, I think people really will appreciate knowing all these little stories and getting a different perspective on New York, on this black man at the time who I was just thinking right before I saw your call come in, I was like, he would have been a CEO of like a Fortune 500 company if given the opportunity. That's how I feel.
Yes.
Like seriously, you know, all the organizing he did and things like that, you know. Okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself, so I'm excited here. I just want to let the people know that you're a Bundles Community Scholar of Columbia University as well. So where did this history bug hit you? Like, when did it hit you?
Well, it hit me in actually 2013 just approaching it. Grand Central Terminal in New York City was about to celebrate its centennial. So it's going to be 100 years old. And I also am a licensed tour guide, and I was asked if I would give a tour of Grand Central Terminal. It's not really my beat. I mostly focus on Upper Manhattan. But they were kind of in a bind, the Municipal Art Society that had the had won the sort of concession to run the tours because their training program had been sabotaged in part by Hurricane Sandy. So a lot of the trainees couldn't get
training.
And I lived in the city and, you know, the subways were working. So I thought, you know, what the heck? So I wanted to write something about Grand Central, and I did not want to write about architecture because everyone would be focusing on that. And I knew that African Americans had a long history with the railroad. I think at that point, I thought Pullman porters and Red Caps were just the same thing. And very quickly I learned that they were different. So, and for people who don't know, because, you know, we're generations away from this kind of occupation, Pullman porters or sleeping car porters, they rode the rails. The Red Caps worked the stations. But what they had in common was that they were chiefly African-American men. And the fellow, I didn't realize I was hitting pay dirt because Grand Central Terminal was influential to railroad stations across the nation. So whatever was happening there, other railroad stations were trying to emulate. Kind of like Central Park, great parks across the continent were trying to emulate what they were doing there. So he was the first African-American to integrate what had been an all-white workforce that had been started in 1895. and that didn't last very long. So 8 years later, in 1903, James H. Williams was hired, and then within a year, it became entirely black. So I think this was an orchestrated move by the management of the New York Central line, so that, because this was the lowest echelon really of workers in the station. And the whites who had originally been hired to do this, one of the requirements is that they have language skills, because it was New York City and you have a polyglot population that's coming through the station, and it needed to be able to greet people. So that kind of fell by the wayside. But if you've got language skills and you're white, and you're carrying other people's bags, you're not going to be gruntled. You're going to be disgruntled in a very short period of time, and you can get another job. And so I did not come across any kind of protest when he was hired, which would have been not atypical when a black person integrates a white environment, which suggests to me that this was an orchestrated move and that all of those white employees were able to get other jobs elsewhere, either in the station or somewhere else. So he became the first.
Let me just stop you for a second here. Let's go back a little bit. So you got this bug in 2013. We're now in 2020. I think the book came out 2019. I saw that you went to France to work on the book. How did that happen?
Yes. So I was, as a lot of my research was coming together, I kind of need to be away from the city, from all the hubbub. And so it was a fellowship, a residency in the south of France for creatives. And I was accepted, and I took a month's time. And that really helped me I didn't do as much research there. It was basically kind of organizing a lot of the research that I had already done during my Leon Levy Fellowship in New York, and through the resources of Columbia University as a bundle scholar. So it was a month that was like, it was kind of a necessary downtime, in the sense that, you know, I was not being overstimulated by traffic and my refrigerator and phone calls. And it enabled me to pull together a lot of the research that I had already amassed and organized it.
I understand you got to contact his great-grandson. How did that connection happen? Did you look up his phone number on the phone?
No, did you connect with him? It was interesting because another writer who's now a friend, she was a journalist, and she was working on, a lot of her beat was the New York City Fire Department, and she had been working on a book on the century-long struggle to integrate New York's bravest. And we had a conversation because she was trying to get a sense of what Harlem was like when the first Manhattan's first black fireman was hired in 1919. And his name was Wesley Williams. And as we're talking, she said, Wesley Williams' grandson is actually still around and he's been very helpful. And she knew that Wesley's father had been like a red cap. And I'm working on something about red caps. And I put two and two together and I got four. So I was like, Wesley Williams, James H. Williams. And so she put me in touch with Wesley's grandson, who is James's great grandson. So this was fantastic, and Charles Ford Williams gave me really carte blanche to look at all the photos. He became sort of the family repository for things historic. So he had tons of photos, many of which he could identify, but many more of which he could not. And so my research helped to identify a lot of these photos, like, James Williams' daughter Gertrude, in this picture, she's with this fellow who used to hang out with the actress Florence Mills' entourage, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really a boon in terms of my research, because most of this stuff was not found in archives. You know, things were kind of scattered. And
he
people's
seemed like a
papers
private
and things
kind of
like
guy.
That.
He seemed kind of private, based on just what I was just grabbing at. But let's talk to the audience and let them know that when I was talking that he could be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, the reason I say that is with good cause, because in your book, you talk about him being over more than 300 men working the station, organizing them, training them, also working with other train stations. Like you said, it was like a model station type of thing. But beyond that, he was a leader in other places where he was a leader with the Black Elk. Talk to the audience about that.
Right. So, you know, the fraternal organizations like the Elks and other fraternal organizations, these have been historically really, really important for the Black community as it was growing and spreading across the country. They often raise money for different philanthropic causes, be it for, for orphanages or for the war effort. So he was an officer in the Manhattan Lodge number 45, which was this first, I think it was the first of the Elks, Black Elks in Manhattan. And it grew very, very quickly, and it was mostly Harlem-based. And he organized, he and his associate, Sam Jesse Battle, were on the the committee that kind of organized, like got the caterers in line and hired the musicians and that sort of thing. That man I just mentioned was his assistant, who became New York City's first Black police officer while he was studying at the Red Cap and passed it in 1911. So he had his hand in all of these kinds of things, and the Elks, as they say, were really critical to the growth of the Black community and were the center of a lot of social activities of the Black community.
Now, he also organized the Red Caps, not just in terms of their training and development as Red Caps, but development the baseball team and a basketball team. In the world? Go ahead. Tell us about that.
Well, you think about it this way. I mean, all of us who were in junior high school, high school, we probably had a school, basketball, football, running team, that sort of thing. It helps you to express yourself as an athlete or a creative person, maybe a school orchestra or whatever, but also represents the institution that you are a part of. And it was no different there. But one of the things that was unique, so he starts an orchestra because a lot of these Red Caps are professional quality musicians. It does a couple of things. It lifts up the morale because this is a grunt job, and I wasn't interested in celebrating the job, but I was interested in celebrating this, the spirit of the valor of the men who have to perform this, many of whom are college students. And he was very particular about, not exclusively, but he hired particularly a lot of young Black college students who had various skills, and a lot of them were musicians. So he puts together this orchestra. It not only represents
the Central
Terminal.
See, that right there dispels a myth, Eric. Eric, that dispels a myth right there that these men were going to college. You know, a lot of people might have assumed, like, they don't have any educational background, so that's why they're taking this job. This is probably all they could get.
No, they had no
choice. But that was not the reason that they were working that job. It's because they were Black people in America.
Exactly.
And this was actually a good job to make money and help them pay for college based on your book's reading. Go ahead. Sorry, you were going to talk some more. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Right. I'm glad you emphasized that, because it was not uncommon to see headlines. I mean, for many, it was like a novelty to see that these men who were famously overqualified for this job, and you might occasionally see headlines like PhD carries your bags, but they were relegated to these jobs by dint of being Black, so they didn't have the options that young white college men would have had in terms of job opportunities. But the orchestra thing, I think it lifted the morale, but it also made them autonomous, because while they performed often at the station, but they also performed at places like the famous San Gennaro Festival down in Little Italy that happened every year, or they could hire themselves out. So this giving them this kind of autonomy helped them economically and also professionally because they could make sort of their own names. He had a baseball team, and they were competitive among, you know, the Negro League players, particularly during the First World War around 1918 when he pulls them together. He organizes a basketball team. And so all of these things are kind of contributing to community building because they bring people together. People are able to kind of show their chops in whichever particular athletic or musical field that they have. And one of the important things that he organized was a mutual aid society among the Red Caps. And this was very important. He did this early on when he became the chief.
Yeah.
Because they were not insured. They were vulnerable. And Grand Central Terminal, you know, was being built over the old Grand Central Station and still functioning, you know, with Swiss watch precision. But you can imagine with all these detours along the way, and here, you know, they're having to carry people's bags and walking along the platforms, there were casualties. Williams' own daughter was in the hospital, which was right next door to Grand Central, and they were not insured. So he organizes a mutual aid society where you would everyone would contribute something, and this way it would help pay for the cost of, say, a funeral or sick leave or someone's wife is pregnant. Or it's you know, hard times.
You just mentioned his daughter. Now, is this the young daughter? She passed away. She was sick for about a year, you mentioned in the book.
Doris. So we didn't get to know her as an adult. And she had had an affliction, you know, I think that was, I don't know if it was congenital, but from her early years. And it was through things like this mutual aid society that would, I'm sure, that helped to defray the cost of the funeral, which are real costs for real people.
Yeah. Now, the earlier conversation, I'm going to go back to this, where you met your friend and you were talking and she's doing a study about black firefighters. His son was the first black firefighter in Manhattan. Tell the audience about his son. He was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, so Wesley Williams, he's born in 1897, and he is he passes the test. I think the figure was 1,700 applicants. He's the only black applicant, and he's the only one who scores of 1,700 men 100% on the physical examination.
Go
he's
Wesley.
This bodybuilder. Yeah. A teetotaler, didn't drink, didn't smoke. We would call them health nuts today. I guess maybe health nuts is already old-fashioned, but he was like one of the earliest of the health nuts. And he worked at, when he got hired, all the men tried to quit. The captain of the station did quit. The commissioner would not let the other men quit. They had to stick around for a year, but they ostracized him. And so when he went upstairs, they went downstairs and vice versa. They gave him a bed by the toilet.
They tried to kill him. You know, oh, my God.
Yeah.
They tried to kill him.
And they tried.
Like, tell him about
that.
That's crazy.
Fighting a fire. There was a fire. He was stationed on Broome Street in what's now sort of the Little Italy, Chinatown area of Lower Manhattan. And there was a fire. And they all went out to him. He's like, you know, goes in and... As they came out, they left him in there, in the smoke. And one of the fire officers came to the scene, and he was trying to account for all the men. And he was on Wesley's side. And they said, oh, he's still there. That's too bad. And out of the smoke, as in a movie, comes Wesley, and he survived it.
That's a movie. That is a movie scene, okay, Eric? Oh, my God. I can totally see. This is a jump. This is a breakoff TV show about Wesley, nothing to do with his father, but obviously his father, I'm sure, was a great influence. Another crazy story in there, the Prince Henry of Prussia story. Okay.
Yes.
Talk about
Henry. Yeah, 1902, Henry of Prussia. He's making this goodwill tour of the United States, and he starts in New York, And, of course, anybody with even – and it's all by railroad, you know. Anybody with the slightest German extraction is doing their German pride thing from the Lederhosen to whatever, you know, and they're rushing down to the station to meet him. And what they don't know is that the prince is really, like, into black music. And at the time, for him, that's spirituals. Because some 30 years later, when he was a little boy in his little palace over in Prussia, the Fisk Jubilee Singers have their world tour in 1871.
I could not believe that. That was
and they
so crazy.
And, yeah, and he's smitten, and he wants to hear black music. And so he meets the Fisk Jubilee Singers when he gets to Nashville. And one of the singers he still remembers, she's, I think, because the cast has sort of changed, but one of them is still there from the original. And he's thrilled. When he comes back to New York, he's brought to Marshall's down on 53rd Street, which was this famous hotel cabaret. So he's the new music that's coming up, the, you know, ragtime. And he goes back because he's really taken by this Williams had worked for this florist, Charles Thorley.
He's, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
he was one of the most famous florists of the Gilded Age, who a lot of people don't know. He was also well known for hiring black staff and contributing to black causes. And so he had done this big, he had done the floral decor for this big reception for the prince at Madison Square Garden. And he left, and he left the guy in charge to do it. I'm already forgetting his name, but he was one of the black workers.
Cummings.
And the prince
Cummings.
So
mm-hmm.
the prince wasn't
mm-hmm.
so impressed with the reception, because he gets receptions all the time. But he stopped before leaving early. You know, the singers were like, oh, my gosh, he's walking out. You know, but before he leaves, he's like, he takes in the flowers. He says, who did this? And everyone looks for Thorley, and Thorley's not there. But the guy who actually did the work, Cummings, was there. And he hires Cummings
and
when
Cummings
he does his tour and comes back to New York. Cummings was a black man. And he takes Cummings to be his floral director on the ship, the Deutschland, back to Germany. And then he sends, pays Cummings way back home. He gives him a diamond-studded watch, letters of it. So Cummings becomes sort of famous and enters the business on his own for a while, the floral business. So these kind of connections were also things that Williams was able to kind of keep track of. He was well known for knowing almost anybody there was to know in New York City, black or white. And he was able to sort of weave these connections, these networks together for the betterment of the uplift was the urgent theme of the time of his people.
He was definitely involved in a lot of things. Yeah, he was definitely involved in supporting a lot of he supported the YMCA, different buildings. That's why he got the Red Caps together, donating money. He helped them with getting bonds. I mean, he just, like I said, he was, if given the opportunity, I definitely could see. And he knew all these superstars that you talk about in the book and
yes.
the pictures. It's just really
amazing.
Yeah,
it was said you were not a big shot unless he recognized you. Even
see,
if you
look
you
at there.
Yeah.
Look at there. I mean, I saw a picture with him and Joe Louis, I think it was. They were walking.
Right.
And he looked so small. In the pictures that I saw, I thought, oh, but this guy looks tall. But then you see him next to Joe Louis, and I'm like, oh, wow, okay.
Right. Yeah. I'll tell you, Joy,
but,
I'm thrilled now because he was one of the last students of this school, this grammar school, the racial caste school that was discontinued in 1894. And he would have been one of the last in the classes. But the building is still there in the neighborhood of Chelsea today. And I'm actually spearheading a campaign to get it landmarked, and things as I speak are looking rather positive. Nothing's on paper yet. But that's it's a beautiful connection if this works out to Williams and others who graduated from there and the world that he had been attached to during that period, during the late 19th century. So,
well, now, what are you working on next? I heard you're writing like a group biography. of a multiple New Yorkers. Yeah. Is that true? Or
I'm working on a couple of things. One is a biography of Richard Huey, who is a Broadway actor, restaurateur, who is in Boss of the Grips. He gets hired by Williams. Williams doesn't want to hire him, he says, but he has a letter of recommendation from W.E.B. Du Bois, so that kind of changes things.
Oh, that guy, yes. Oh, my God. Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. But also, I think I'm starting on a group biography of people who are associated educators and students of this school that I just mentioned, Colored School Number 4 on West 17th Street that Williams attended, because there's just this fantastic crew of people who came in and out of those doors there.
Wow.
So I've got
my
hands full there.
that's amazing. Yeah, like people, we can't even talk. I mean, there's stuff about Roosevelt in here that I would love to talk, but we're coming down to our time. Eric, I'm going to be giving away some copies of your book.
Wonderful.
Where can people follow you on social media? I know you have your website, but what's your hook again on social media, like Twitter, Instagram?
I'm on Twitter, EK Washington. I'm on Instagram, Eric K. Washington. And so I'm easy to find there. My Instagram is mostly photos, but there's a lot of texted things. I have two sites on Instagram, Eric K. Washington, and also Tagging in the Past, which is a lot of sort of local history nuggets.
I have one last question for you, Eric. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, the question I'm always afraid of. I think it would be able to zip back into time for like 10 minutes, just the time to do a quick interview with somebody. Fantastic, who I've been researching.
10 minutes.
But I don't
want to
get stuck there.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay. So you gotta come going there and coming back. That's important.
Right. It has to be round trip. That's superpower.
Round trip. Look at there. All right, Eric. It was really a pleasure talking to you this morning. I wish you so much luck.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe we'll talk again about your next book. I would love to probably have you back on.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay,
have a great
weekend. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Just got off the phone with historian Eric K. Washington. I'm going to be giving away some copies of his book, Boss of the Grips, The Life of James H. Williams and the Red Top of Grand Central. Follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. I'm going to be on Instagram as soon as I get off the phone here. We're going to be talking about migraines with the Migraine Diva. So you want to go to my Instagram account if you want to follow that. It's a live video chat with her. Again, Saturdays with Joy Keys. That's my hook on Instagram. The show's on iTunes, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. You guys have a great weekend, and I may see you on Instagram. Bye-bye.